to another installment of New Books in Poetry's month-long celebration of the chapbook, Chapbookapalooza. And actually, Lynn, now that I have you here, how do you pronounce your last name? Is it Strongin?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's a Russian name and a hard G. You got it right.
Okay, so we'll start the silence again. I just wanted to make sure I had that right. Welcome to another installment of New Books in Poetry's month-long celebration of the chapbook, Chapbookapalooza. I am your host, Jen Fitzgerald. Lynn Strongin was born in 1939 in New York City into a middle-class Jewish family, contracted polio at the age of 12. She attended the Manhattan School of Music, Hunter College, and Stanford University, where she earned a Master of Arts in Literature. In the 1960s, she lived in politically active Berkeley, collaborating with Denise Levertov, who described her as a true poet. Since 1979, Strongin has lived in British Columbia and published more than a dozen books. Her work appears in 30 anthologies. She has received grants and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, American Association of University Women, and Penn American Center. Countrywoman Surgeon was nominated for the Elliston Award in 1979 and Spectral Freedom for a Pulitzer Prize in 2009. In 2015, Headmistress Press published her poetry collection, The Burn Poems, which Alicia Ostreicher called fascinating work. Welcome, Lynn.
Well, I'm very happy to be here and thank you, Jennifer, and to thank the women at Headmistress Press. Up here in Victoria, Canada, and we had a very small crowd for a very big reading because the people were so warm. And the hostess, the woman who runs Headmistress, said, "You see, you have this gold here, you have this poet. We have lost her, and you have her now." And I said, "Oh no, I'll forever be an American poet, my heart." So, people call me a Canadian poet, but I'm not. I'm an American poet. And that's an important distinction in the language I use.
Absolutely. And I can tell you that America is not willing to let you go.
Oh, good. That's lovely. It's a mutual thing then. Great.
So let's start our conversation off with a poem. Would you please read for us The Tenderness of the Wren? And if there's anything you'd like to tell us about this piece, I invite you to do so.
I've always had the opinion that a poem says everything it has to say about itself in its own words. So I will simply start with the title. The listener can contemplate while I read what the tenderness of the wren, that tiny little bird, what it means and how it fits into their life, if it does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The tenderness of the wren. The heart it gives us when the beloved gets well. The sunken anchor through the blue of death bond when they fail to heal. Some days, patterning walls with rude mice, church mice, sisters take all the breath one likes, like blowing out candles when on a lung machine. I'll set the iron hand, not breathless yet, but nearly won, over to the other side. I had a terror, so I sang. Under my breath, over and under swam the blue fish out of eternity. My miniature nurse with a toe bunion is worse. The love keeps with the tender telling of small things, the imprint song in the embryo or full blown, air like corn silk, like milk. The dignity we must accord each other, glacial, then comes the wind. Warm-hearted laughing comes the girl from Ireland, and she sips for me, and I agonize.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I don't know if listeners will remember the iron lung, but I was caught in the big polio epidemic of 1951, and I lay in my bed reading the headlines, polio, obesity, and salt and saline were just coming in 1951. So that is the lung I refer to. It's become a mystical thing in my life. And I said to both my mother and father, isn't that wonderful? If I have children, they'll never catch polio. Mm. And then I looked at them and noticed that both of them had wet eyes. There were tears in their eyes. Mm. The other reference I'll point out to the listener as I sang because I had a terror, that comes from our great Emily Dickinson, who sang Besides Grace. Do you know that one, Jen?
I don't think I do.
It's got to go when this is over and read that poem because it meets all of mine and is wonderful.
I will. Thank you.
And the next poem you would like me to read is a reliquary.
Yes, a reliquary evening for sure, please.
Okay. A reliquary evening for sure. This is a poem first by Charles Wright, the American poet. The bones in their tiny boxes, rosettes under glass. Charles Wright, Last Supper from the Wrong End of the Rainbow. I guess that's the end without gold spot. Nostalgia is an apron. I want her true. I want her home. I want her deep down. The down of the owl feathering for night, each pinion in order, like a letter on a printer's tray. I want her to stay close, not paralyzed like me, but tense in her apron of photography, printed, filmic security. The image, holy, holy, holy. Lift comes like a flare of lit match, it could be blown out by word or gesture, a spoon shaken in the nod of a preacher making the spoon nod. Is the wrong end of the rainbow the one with no pot of gold? Darkness closes in. It cannot be my imagining. The day before, she, my beloved, she bird, must go back to work. Let's proceed carefully, not lay the fairy tale book away. Office behavior, the stacking of things, my stacking of hopes, sliding. Maybe she loves me for all the labor as her sick child who had to be positioned in a certain way. Two hot water bottles, one on the lumbar spine, one higher, an ice pack on the popo. Maybe patching me with cold. Now dashing away, flashing butterflies under glass, like essence under glass. Winter has foam cutlery. God knows during these days, sick home becomes cooking soup, polishing cutlery, propping pillows, cubicle of curing every corner of day, like mail spots in old hotels. Like pushing into darkness and the back of the medicine cabinet, all that came over the months and years from the local pharmacy. Help us to hold fast to what makes us button the top button of the cape most tenderly. Let it cover all of me. Of me.
Thank you very much. This is one of my favorite poems in this collection.
Oh, thank you. Those two last ones are sort of, they're love poems, poems of longing for the she and the woman. And I'm glad you said that, but I thought they might be a bit out there on the branch where I tend to go, and I'm glad they reached you because because that's why I wrote them, really. Rummaging through boxes of old lace as follows. And this is a sort of cycle. It goes, you know, from one poem to another. You chose well, Jen. You're a good chooser of poems, the order of them.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Ruminating in a scrum. Love and anger combined. Soot gray, ink black, thunder color, hues of love and anger, boot string, shoelaces. Braces were stropped, not high, black, little old lady shoes. I came upon a series of ancient orthopedic braces for legs, for back, for neck. The moon at its basis. Burning above one candle, for love, one for ecstasy. Turned back upon when youth ended. We had it so good. Teddy, who would want a paralytic infant? It started up again in 74th year. It kicked back at me, the boar with fistful of wild figs and more things. Was an everlasting thing. Don't call it by its name. Word magic then. Don't look at it in a mirror, double. Don't use the words that friend. My nearest, dearest, rummaging among cartons of old dress laces. It grew, blew, a leaf. I found one was a child. Engraved string. My fingers cut off at the second joint with dirty string. It wanted to have the shape of a heart, but ended in the shape of steeple collapsing. I stroked it in both hands, cupped a bird on the wing, was bashed into a window one foggy night long ago. 100 years ago, in the past century, and that's the end of the burning. The unsung carol, the not mentioned, private, bone deep.
Thank you so much.
I'm that's the meaning of the burning part. That's like burn.
I know that many of the poems in this collection have a speaker who thinks deeply about ability and illness, and you as the poet have been candid about your own history of varied ability. Do you want to talk a little bit about how this speaker developed, how this clear and concise voice that carries us through the collection came into being?
Work. work and more work and blood, sweat, and tears. I was drawn to the very early music, which has four staves, four lines. If you know Garibaldi, if you know Gesualdo, very, very early music is simple. And in college, I studied complex poems. I studied Milton, of course, and studied Scott, and I studied The Lady of the Lake, and I hated it. I found it so gruesome. And then, in my 20s, Denise Levertov, I handed some poems of mine and ran away. I was too shy to stay for an interview at Berkeley where she was visiting for it for a week. All these kids were reading their poems out loud about, and then he died in the muck of the war and the blood ran all over him. I mean, it was gruesome. It was tabloid writing. And I had 10 rather simple poems and read nothing. I said, thank you, Miss Levertov, handed them to her, and ran as fast as I could in my silver wheels, which is my pet name for the wheelchair, which goes through life with me. So I rolled through life rather than walking. And I saw how simple her poems were. And I waited to hear from her in Somerset, in Massachusetts, in a certain magical part of Massachusetts. And about 2 days later, I got the packet in a scrawl writing of a doctor. You know, no one could ever read doctors or lawyers' language, so, or writing. And it was from Denise at the laptop, Grover, both, and Massachusetts. And I opened it up, and in her large writing, she said, "These are the poems, indeed, of a true poet.
Wow.
Keep in touch. But keep in touch. I am interested."
Wow. That's awesome.
It was. And for that, after that, I was so moved. The friend who took me to Denise said, "What did she say? What did she say about your work?" And I said, "Oh, nothing much. She just found it was true." And they said, "She found it was true?" "Yes, I guess true to itself. I don't know true to what, but at least it's not phony. So it ain't phony." I couldn't write for about a year. I was so stunned by her comments. But then I did, and one of my poems called Pascal poem, which, as you know, is the word for Easter. It's not in the Burn poems. Very early. I wrote about a vacant lot that faced my house in Berkeley. And the boy is about 9 or 10. I caught polio 2 years older at 12, but I've always identified with boys walking through vacant lots and climbing trees. And I believe in androgyny. I believe all of us are a combination of sex, really. And I am a girl, boy. So I looked at him and identified and said, "What is it to be so slender, boy, to walk the burning fields at dusk? Must be the core of it." And in that I'm north, I become like Shakespeare's young creatures. I become a young boy as well. That is a persona. But when I'm always slipping in and out of so easily that I kidded my mother, "I'm your best boy," and my sister said, "I'm a boy too." And this is such a strong influence. We stopped having periods. We looked differently. We really felt the only way to get anywhere in the world in the 1950s in America was to be a boy. We were totally wrong. She got to Carnegie Hall. She's a star artist. And I got wherever I am. I'm up here on the foggy west coast of Canada for the woman I love. And we couldn't both, I'm afraid, so I did. But we have inside us the core, I think, of both boys and girls. And that's why I wrote that one. Otherwise, well, who is my speaker? That's a really good question that you, Jan, put forth last night. And I never had that. I don't know who the speaker is, but I know that I, as the speaker, become whoever is reading the poem, or saying the poem.
I can see that. And the idea of your poems being true, to me it feels like maybe the speaker of your poems is a version of your truest self.
Yes, I hope it is. I become that person when I write and rewrite and rewrite that poem. Through blood, sweat, and tears. Yes, I was just opening to page 18. I don't know who of your readers has the book, but I said, "When even the rag doll looks corksy." And you know those moments when everything around you has the look of failing and fading and even of death. And children could look at a rag doll and say, "Hey, my rag doll lost her right eye. She's bleeding. She looks fake. She's going to die, Mama, any minute now." So I looked at my favorite rag doll. She did look sort of corpse-like. I said, "Even when the rag doll looks corpse-y, you look limp when we woke up today. We never got up." So I transformed myself and the lover into two tired-out old rag dolls, which is how one feels so many days. Yeah, we take it.
Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure and a real honor to have you on to this program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So this is Jen Fitzgerald with New Books in Poetry, reminding you to support all the arts, but especially poetry.